This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Colostrum LD from Sovereign Laboratories. Colostrum LD is clinically proven to maintain optimal immune function, eliminate harmful pathogens, and fight infection, as well as cleanse and prevent the absorption of toxins. Adding Colostrum LD daily to your diet provides the essential nutrition needed to maintain optimal health. To order, just go to sovereignlaboratories.com. That's sovereignlaboratories.com. If you're a first-time customer, you can get a full 5-day supply for free. Just go to sovereignlaboratories.com for Colostrum LD. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Today, it's our weekly Q&A with Layla. I'm joined by Layla Mudin, who's our nutritionist in residence. And together, we answer your questions. Questions can come to us via radio program at AOL.com. Radio program, one word, at AOL.com. And that's destination for questions related to medicine or nutrition. And we got a full mailbag full of questions, right, Layla?
Yes, we do.
Okay. Before we do that, though, I want to tackle, it seems like beginning of these Q&As, we often have to do damage control.
Yeah.
On the latest anti-supplement journalistic malpractice.
Yes.
And that's what it is.
I like that you called it malpractice, Dr. Hoffman.
Because it is, I took journalism in junior high school and high school. I was on the school paper, and they taught us some basic precepts of journalism, which is that if there's a story that you, maybe it's an expose of some sort, that you go to the other side for an opinion, and even if there's a blanket denial, Trump's critics say this, but the administration answers that, the White House responded that it's all, quote, fake news. At least you give the other side a chance to represent.
Balance reporting.
So-called balance reporting.
Yeah.
Here's yet another episode of unbalanced reporting, because the BBC, which is a venerable news source, it's state radio.
Yeah.
Or state media in England.
Mm-hmm.
It's NPR on steroids.
Oh, totally.
Because it's government media in that country. The BBC ran an article entitled "Probiotics Labeled Quite Useless."
Oh, no.
The very blanket statement about a whole category of supplements.
Mm-hmm.
And what is it based on? It's based on a study done at the Weizmann Institute of Science. And I don't have any great quarrel with the researchers in Israel who published a study in a very reputable journal called Cell where they studied probiotics. And what they discovered is actually something I've been seeing, which is that when you give probiotics to people, sometimes they don't show up in their stool tests.
Ah, yes.
You know, and I'm a case in point. Single day I take Dr. Hira's probiotics. I've taken other types of probiotics through my career. I've had my stool analyzed, and guess what? Zero lactobacillus on some tests. In some cases, zero bifidobacteria.
Interesting.
And I also consider myself as having a relatively healthy gut.
You know,
I think I feel pretty balanced. I don't suffer from a lot of GI symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm relatively healthy in general. So what's up with that? Well, what the BBC article mistakes is the efficacy of probiotics versus their ability to colonize. Probiotics.
Two different things.
Yeah. Probiotics, in my opinion, have an organizing effect sometimes on other organisms within the microbiome.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit like saying,
They're lobbyists for other microbiomes.
Yeah. It's a little bit like doing a satellite photo of an army in a battlefield and saying, there must be some general here, but I can't see him. You know, he doesn't seem to be, we can't culture out a general.
Yeah.
But the general is actually directing the army.
Mm-hmm.
But from a bird's eye view, you can't see the general, you know, from like 30,000 feet, you know, with a spy satellite, you can't see the general.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a little bit like what I think probiotics tend to do, is they may, through some interactive effect, organize, the bacteria. They actually produce certain substances which have an inhibitory effect on certain bacteria or an encouraging effect on certain bacteria.
They nudge the ecosystem in a favorable direction, hopefully, most of the time.
And so the failure to colonize is not necessarily a hallmark of failure of efficacy of the probiotics.
Yes, true. Yeah.
So anyway, that is our this week's instance of journalistic malpractice.
And,
you know, I think
stay tuned for next week's instance of journalistic malpractice.
You know what? I think in my next career, I'm going to set up a like a postgraduate program for health journalists so that they can actually.
We need you now.
Yeah, so that they can actually. Know how to look at a study and not say, I'm taking this on, on its word, but that they can actually critique the study. They know its flaws. They know its inadequacies. And they know how to do a proper balanced story around the latest study.
And it's necessary.
And source all the players in that community. And I don't think that in the BBC story, I have to confess to not seeing it, but I don't think they reached out to the nutrition community adequately to get their version of the story.
Which is the why it can be characterized as malpractice, really.
Yeah.
If you're not. How do you write about something you don't know?
Yeah.
Which goes on every day now in journalism.
Well, the supposition is that there's all these idiots out there who are taking supplements. They have no idea what they're taking.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all a big scam.
Mm-hmm.
And people are making millions and billions of dollars selling these worthless supplements. And that's the perspective that I think a lot of these journalists take towards supplements.
Yeah.
They're all in the thrall of conventional medicine. They'll extol the latest cancer cure, which doesn't pan out ultimately.
Right.
But when it comes to nutrients and supplements, they bring a very skeptical perspective to that.
Yeah. And with all the advertising, pharma's advertising, even in magazines like Women's Day and Good Housekeeping and Glamour magazine, I was at the hair salon last week. I noticed all these
drug
ads.
You don't seem like the
yeah. I don't read that stuff.
Yeah, right. It's like
I'm passing the time. So many drug ads,
really?
More than anything, more than for a shampoo.
What kind of drug ads are drug ads are in a woman's magazine?
Cancer, autoimmune.
Right.
Psoriasis,
yeah.
Absolutely.
Right.
Things like that.
You know what I noticed?
Eczema.
Do you watch much TV? You watch a little bit of TV.
I
see ads for these super pricey cancer drugs.
Yeah.
Drugs like Ibrance, which is really...
I've seen that, right.
Rarely used.
Yeah.
The drug costs hundreds of thousands of dollars per year.
Mm-hmm.
But what are you supposed to do as a layperson? You're supposed to say, I've got cancer. I saw this ad for this super expensive drug, and you're going to tell your doctor to prescribe that? How could you possibly know whether that drug is appropriate for you, and why are they marketing it directly to consumers?
That's exactly what they want you to do, is go to your doctor and demand that drug or that test.
And I think the reason for that is that if they have a million people are watching the show, and if just 15 or 20 people resonate with that, that's enough to pay for that ad time.
Sure.
Those drugs are so expensive.
Yeah.
That, you know.
Yeah.
And it's different than like Prilosec for heartburn, you know, or Lipitor. You don't make that much money on those drugs. A lot of those are off patent, and you can't make that much money off them.
Yeah.
But these monoclonal antibodies, these very esoteric medications, very expensive, are the ones that are being advertised. What's up with that? I mean, who's it's one thing to advertise like a headache remedy. You go to the store and you buy a headache remedy. Are you going to make your doctor, compel your doctor to give you this expensive drug?
Well, as we know, that cancer is very, very big business.
I guess
and
so.
It's very, lucrative for many.
And incidentally, the other thing that is misrepresented by these ads is that none of these drugs has ever been demonstrated to cure cancer.
That's true.
At best, they're approved on the basis of, quote, response.
Uh-huh.
Like if you have a drug that gives you a 40% response rate, which means that the cancer shrinks and you may live a few additional months, that drug is approved and becomes a blockbuster.
Wow. That's
and yet really we hold our supplements to different standards, right?
Yeah.
probiotics are useless.
No sense at all.
Okay.
That's unfortunate. I wanted to
we'll get our soapbox now and we'll answer some questions.
Stay tuned for more journalistic malpractice.
Right. You can be sure we're going to have some more instances of it.
Honestly. Well, we have to.
It's a gift. Every week we get, we get a gift of some other,
Well, I think people also count on us to dispel the myths. So that's what we're also here to do.
Okay.
So I want to clear up something. I've got an email from somebody who loves listening to the Intelligent Medicine podcasts, and in particular was asking me about one of mine, Alayla Weighs In, and for some of the notes from that show. And I responded saying, just go to drhoffman.com, and I want to tell everybody else, go to drhoffman.com, click on listen, and you will find an index of all the podcasts, the radio shows, and so on and so forth. And he was looking in particular for show references, the things that I referenced.
Right.
And we only show notes for podcasts, but for your Saturday radio show,
exactly,
you have a list of references that you're talking about there.
So, for example, for today's podcast,
we
are not going to provide the references to each individual study that we talk about.
Right.
But for the Saturday show, we do compile that.
Yes.
And that's a big effort.
Yeah.
But we do that for the Saturday listeners.
Yeah.
If you want to start a GoFundMe for, for us to do references for everything that comes out of our mouths.
That's all we'll do. We'll have to stop talking.
We'll have to stop practicing, too.
We'll have to stop practicing.
Right.
I just wanted to let Connor know, and Connor, thank you for your email, is that what I do during my podcasts is I reference more than once, and if I haven't, call me out on it, I do reference more than once where my source is, where I'm getting it from.
So you're not just making it up.
I'm not making it up.
Okay.
I got this from Journal of Endocrinology and Metabolism. I got this from worldhealth.net. These were the dates I accessed it.
And that's good for a couple of reasons. One is that you're not making it up, and the other thing is it's not plagiarism.
Exactly.
So that it,
oh,
it,
yeah.
yeah. You know, because sometimes, yeah. and people sometimes just do that. They lift whole articles. I've had it happen to me. It's like I've seen like, oh my God, that's exactly word for word what I've written, and it's like copied and pasted into somebody else's website.
Exactly.
I've seen that with the salad and salmon diet, for example, and it's, somebody else's name is on top of it.
We need plagiarism police. No, it's true. And so you can go back and listen to the podcast again and listen for my reference and go find it. So, Connor, thank you for your email.
And I really appreciate that because that speaks to such a high level of involvement with our podcast.
Yeah.
It's a little bit like someone who's, doesn't just cut the meat from the bone, but gnaws the bone and then breaks the bone open to extract the marrow.
Exactly.
You know, it's like you really get it. You want to get your mileage out of every podcast.
Yes.
And thanks for going that extra mile to extract every nugget of critical information.
Especially if it's a lamb bone marrow, that's the best one.
Thing called ossobuco, right? Which that's marrow, right?
Yeah, it's marrow. But I think you could also, you do that with veal shank or beef shank.
That's veal shank, right?
Yeah, more than that. Yeah, I find beef marrow not to be as appetizing as lamb marrow. Lamb marrow is absolutely delicious. Have you ever had marrow stew? Oh my goodness.
I can't say I have.
Divine. Anyway.
Yeah.
So.
And what cuisine is that?
Middle Eastern.
That's Middle Eastern. Okay.
Yeah, Middle Eastern.
And that's, sort of nose to tail philosophy. They eat more of the animal.
Delicious.
And there's benefits to bone marrow traditionally is that it's rich in certain nutrients that you don't get from the flesh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely. All right, so we digress. Let me get on to. We have an email from Karen.
We're free associating here, as usual.
We have an email from Karen. Hi, Dr. Hoffman and Layla. I love your podcasts. I listen every night while I cook dinner. Cool.
Oh,
thank you, Karen.
We'll avoid certain subjects then. Some gastrointestinal issues may not be suitable for your listening.
We'll try not to talk about poop.
Fast forward to the next question, please.
I have a question about Dr. Hoffman's newsletter on getting a second opinion on a statin. The article suggests checking whether your LDL is oxidized. Can you please tell me what lab does this test? I used to have this test done, but now cannot find a lab anywhere that will do this. It used to be Shiel, which no longer does.
S-H-I-E-L.
Yeah, which no longer does.
They were acquired by somebody else or something?
Right, by Quest.
Okay.
Quest acquired Shiel.
Right.
But they only do an oxidized LDL. They no longer do...
The ratio.
Ratio.
Well, the ratio was a little bit less acknowledged to be shall we say, accepted by consensus as a metric of risk.
Yeah.
So they dropped that. Quest being a big, high-profile lab, they said, we can't go with that because it's too speculative. But they will give you an oxidized LDL, and they'll give you a range.
Yeah.
And you can then apply that to your LDL and find out if a high percentage of your LDL is the so-called bad kind of LDL.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the other bad kind of LDL is based on particle size. This is based on oxidation.
Yes.
So a couple of ways that LDL can go wrong, small particles. Pattern B particles or oxidation of the LDL. Those are a little different.
Yeah. Yeah. So Quest Diagnostics, which is a pretty common lab, at least here in the Northeast. I don't know where else it would be. But I think Karen is also from the Northeast, so she would know. So, but thank you for your question.
Yeah.
Okay. Cook that dinner. Yay. We like it when people cook.
Yeah. All right, let's pause now because we want to allow one of our sponsors to share a vital message with you, so please listen up.
Did you know the benefits of nature's most powerful superfood are universal and always available no matter what your age? This is Dr. Ronald Hoffman with a nutritional supplement I recommend and use that's clinically proven to maintain optimal immune function, eliminate harmful pathogens and fight infection, and cleanse and prevent the absorption of toxins. It's Colostrum LD from Sovereign Laboratories. Adding Colostrum LD daily to your diet provides the essential nutrition needed to maintain optimal health. With Sovereign's proprietary enhanced delivery system, Colostrum LD is the most effective colostrum available. Colostrum LD has wide-ranging health benefits at every stage of life. To order, just go to SovereignLaboratories.com. That's SovereignLaboratories.com. If you're a first-time customer, you can get a full 5-day supply for free. Just go to SovereignLaboratories.com for Colostrum LD.
Thanks so much for listening, and thank you for supporting our sponsors. They're what make Intelligent Medicine a continuing free resource to you. So now, back to our questions.
We have an email here from Madeline. I was recently diagnosed with a urethral caruncle by a urologist after some...
Caruncle, that's a funny word.
It is a funny word. Caruncle.
Excuse me, is that a caruncle on your nose?
Right.
You know, it's like... Well, actually, I did a little show prep.
Ah.
You know, we go that extra...
For caruncle,
we
yes.
go that extra mile here for you, our listeners. And caruncle, I'm looking up the definition, is a noun. And one is a wattle of a bird, such as a turkey. So a turkey has that kind of thing under its chin, like
double chin.
Right,
the wattle.
Turkey neck.
Mm-hmm.
They should see a plastic surgeon.
Yes.
That's also called a caruncle.
Uh-huh.
But it's also the red prominence at the inner corner of the eye. So that doesn't get us to the urethra.
Huh.
But in women, a urethral caruncle is a small growth that occurs in the urethra, usually in postmenopausal women.
Hmm.
And so that's what that is.
That's what that is.
But it can apply to the eye. And there's that little, you know, if you look at the, you know, the part of your eye that's close to your nose.
Yes.
That little red thing, you know, that's called a caruncle.
Okay.
And,
I wonder if that's what it looks like in a urethra. That might be something.
There's some pictures of a urethra here. You can look it up on
you can Google it.
Google it. Yeah.
Right.
Google images.
Yeah.
It's tiny, and what does it do? I don't know. Does it get in the way?
Yeah.
Does it cause problems with the urethral stream? Let's say it's a little fleshy outgrowth that's benign.
Okay. Here's Madeline's concern. Madeline says, I'm a 70-year-old female. I was given a prescription of topical estradiol.
And why? Because this problem occurs in postmenopausal women. It's thought to be related to estrogen deficiency postmenopausal.
Okay. After reading the ingredients, which include methylparaben, I'm a little hesitant. I also have what I believe is a uterine polyp, which was recently biopsied and is benign. The urologist suggested the estradiol, and I wonder if you have any alternative.
Yeah, the alternative is to use a compounding pharmacy, because a compounding pharmacy will make up a clean version of the estrogen.
Without the
methylparabens. With any vehicle that you want that's a clean, non-toxic vehicle. It just doesn't make sense to apply something vaginally or, to the vulval area, mm-hmm. Where it can be absorbed that has parabens in it.
Right.
These are
antifungals more than anything, methylparaben, different types of
parabens.
They're preservatives.
But they also may have estrogenic effects, and they may have xenoestrogen effects. Do we want them in the body,
Not necessarily. It's ironic, too, given an estrogen supplement having a xenoestrogen also.
They figure, though, that it's a preservative and that you're already applying estrogen, so what's the problem with a little extra estrogen?
Right.
But it's a chemical, so
it's a chemical.
You don't need that, and compounding pharmacies can make it in a cleaner version.
There we go.
Right now, by the way, compounding pharmacies are under fire from the FDA because they want to put a lot of restrictions on their ability to make custom medications for people who prefer a more natural form of these medications.
Yeah, that's unfortunate.
We're working on that at Alliance for Natural Health, the ANH organization that I belong to.
Mm-hmm. Madeline, thank you for your question. Okay, this next one comes from Michelle. Dear doctor, I'm becoming concerned about the amount of sparkling water I consume. I wonder what, if any, effect CO2 has on the body. I understand CO2 in the lungs regulates heartbeat.
Well, it certainly CO2 can contribute to global warming.
That's not settled science.
Oh, wait a minute. You can't say that in public.
No, I can't say that in public, but it's not settled science. Anyhow.
If everybody consumed excessive sparkling water, we would destroy the atmosphere.
Okay, so Michelle is asking, does its presence in the bloodstream, that is CO2, have other effects? How much CO2 remains in the stomach after the initial burp?
You know, that's a really good question, and let's not make fun of it. In effect, CO2 is acidic, and that's why sparkling water has a bit of a tang.
Yes.
If you take too much...
That's why the bubbles feel so lovely on your tongue.
Yeah, it's a flavorless gas, but it actually imparts a flavor to certain taste receptors.
Mm-hmm. CO2 is also a byproduct of our metabolism.
Right.
CO2 in water is a byproduct of glycolysis, electron.
Every exhalation every exhalation.
We exhale CO2.
Yeah, yeah. So the question is, can you actually, let's say you are someone who has trouble eliminating CO2. As someone with severe lung problems may have that problem. Is it possible that the CO2 that you're taking in sparkling water would be absorbed through your gastrointestinal tract and add to the CO2 in your blood that you can't properly eliminate by breathing out? And the answer is probably not.
Probably not, yeah.
And it doesn't really make people more acidic.
Mm-hmm.
What I think you as a nutritionist can answer this, is what are the consequences of drinking too much bubbly for some people?
Gas, burping, belching, flatulence, bloating,
It's basically aerophagia.
Aerophagia,
which is the fancy term for swallowing too much air, which causes belching and gas. I think it's sort of neutral vis-a-vis your metabolism.
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much. Michelle goes on, aside from merchandising, I'm considering buying a soda stream. Is this carbonated water a time bomb? No, my sister loves her soda stream. She's always got seltzer.
Just
in
got
her
bought
fridge.
By PepsiCo.
Is that right?
Yeah, it was an Israeli company, just got acquired by PepsiCola.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Pepsi and Coke are acquiring
billions
a lot.
Of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
It was a big buyout.
So not to worry about.
And you know why?
Why?
Because they were the competition for Pepsi.
Because
things that are in bottles and cans, people were saying, why schlep the bottles and cans? I'll just make it in my kitchen, save money, save the environment. So Pepsi said, let's buy the competition. And then you can have cans or bottles, or you can make your own bubbly, and they will sell you the flavor.
Yes.
Which is probably junk.
Yeah.
You know, but I have a soda stream and I make bubbly. I can't tell you how much of that stuff I drink.
Yeah. Yeah. Remember the phrase, if you can't beat them, join them? So now if you can't beat them, buy them.
Acquire them. Yeah.
Acquire them, right?
Buy them out.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't worry about your soda stream. Soda stream is a good idea. There are a lot of people who don't like the taste of water, but adore a seltzer. If you're one of those people,
encourage me to drink. Yeah.
It's perfectly fine.
Yeah.
Not to worry about the CO2. And again, it's a byproduct of your metabolism. People with COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease.
Yeah, let's talk about that for a minute.
Let's talk about that. They can have...
It's called a respiratory quotient. I learned
respiratory quotient, right. Precisely. Since CO2 is a byproduct of our metabolism, particularly carbohydrate metabolism, the burden for those with COPD can become too much if you're eating a high-carb diet.
Their lungs aren't efficient enough to expel the CO2.
Right. Exactly. And something like emphysema, it's not about the inhale, it's the exhale that can be particularly
difficult.
But it
has to be pretty bad.
It's
not just like a little bit. People can barely get across the room.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true. Absolutely. You're turning blue, pretty much. The COPD diet is, in effect, a very low-carb diet.
Right.
Because it you get a more favorable respiratory quotient from it.
You expel less carbon dioxide.
Exactly. You make less carbon dioxide to exhale.
Yes.
So it's less of a burden
right.
on the lungs.
Right.
So
and
it's
we've,
helpful
We've
that
done
way.
That in a few patients, I
we
think.
Have.
So the only problem with that is that for those patients, sometimes they are so... It requires so much energy just to breathe and just to survive that those patients are often kind of skinny.
Yes.
And so you don't want to restrict their carbs
too
much.
No. We don't want them to lose weight.
Right.
You know,
because they're
using a lot of calories.
They're frail and emaciated sometimes, right?
Yes.
So
yes.
you want to maybe give them fat? Is that
right? Absolutely.
Okay.
Well, a COPD diet is high in fat, thereby low in carbs. So
you
make up the calories that way. So
they teach that in nutrition school?
No, not a COPD diet.
Oh.
It's unfortunate.
You learned that separately.
I learned that separately, that it can be helpful that way.
Yeah, I thought that was part of conventional medicine.
Yeah, I remember being a hospital dietitian, however, and having, part of the geriatric ward was what I covered, and there was a lot of COPD there. And I kept insisting that they needed to eat more fat, but you can't add more fat to a moderate to a high carb diet. That's not the point. You have to lower the carbs.
Right.
But very tough to do when you're on a tube feed.
Right.
And the formula is at least 55% carbohydrate.
Right.
So it's very tough going
right.
in something like that, which is one of the reasons I didn't feel very, very, it wasn't very gratifying being a hospital dietitian.
Right.
Except for
because you were so constrained by
the prudent diet still being low fat and eat this muffin because there's no fat in it diet.
Instead of helping people with their breathing, they were worried they were going to get a heart attack from the fat, which was the last thing that was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, this is a good point at which to pause because we are blown right through our time limit here.
Mm-hmm.
We divide our podcast into two parts. And so give us a preview of what we're going to talk about in part two.
Dr. Hoffman, what do you think of cordyceps mushrooms in the treatment of multiple sclerosis?
Okay, we'll take that up in part two. I'm Dr. Ron Hoffman today with Layla Mutin, who's our nutritionist in residence, and it's our weekly Q&A with Layla. We'll be right back with more of Intelligent Medicine.